Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. On our show today, becoming a mystery shopper. I know, it sounds like a total scam, but the gig actually does exist. We'll talk to Field Agent, a company that connects companies to consumers who use their smartphone to earn a little cash providing in-store data, huh? And income volatility. It's becoming a bigger and bigger social issue in this country. The big swings make it hard for people to budget and can lead to a lot of stress. We'll look at the problem and some potential solutions. Then we talk a lot about the difference between TFSAs and RRSPs when it comes to retirement savings. Today, we're going to build the case for the TFSA, in particular for people in two specific groups. Plus, what to do and what to say when the collection agency comes calling. You actually have some rights. We'll tell you what they are. Let's get started. I started my career in sales for a packaged goods company. A part of the job was going through the grocery store aisles and checking on the price and the placement of every single brand and version of shampoo and detergent and diaper. Store-level data has replaced some of that work, but not all of it. In fact, you might be able to make a few bucks doing some of that work yourself. Jeff Doucette is the general manager for Field Agent Canada, and he joins us now from Newfoundland. How you doing, Jeff?
Great, Bruce. How are you doing?
What is Field Agent and how does it work?
Well, Field Agent is a pretty simple concept at the end of the day. Basically, we have a smartphone app, and Canadians can download that app as well as in six other countries around the world. And we get them to complete small tasks through the app while they're out grocery shopping or going on a coffee run or eating out at a restaurant. And they answer a few questions through the app. They might take a picture or even shoot a selfie video from time to time. And then we pay them money for that information. It's basically leveraging the power of the crowd of people that have our app to get our customers, like the company that you mentioned that you work for. You know, that type of company loves to get data that's fresh and real from right across the country. So we take that data and sell it to our clients.
So what would be an example of a task that someone could complete today, and how much would they get paid for it, and how much time would it take for them to do?
Sure. The tasks really range, to be honest. So there's some simple ones, and there's some more complex ones. The more complex they are, the more you get paid. I would say our average task pays about probably $6 or so on average for someone to complete that. And it could, though, that task could be as simple as going to a grocery store, finding a new lineup of cookies that has just been launched, and telling us, you know, which of the flavors are on the shelf, and taking a picture so we can prove that those items are actually on the shelf at that particular grocery store.
So not a full-time gig at $6 a pop. What would an average agent earn in a year?
An average agent's probably earning, if they're checking the app on a regular basis, you know, they might be making $150, $200 a year. We have about 200 people every year that make more than $500. So for the most part, it's, extra Starbucks money or extra money to spend on whatever you like. Helps pay your cell phone bills or that sort of thing. But it's really, it doesn't take a lot of extra time. You don't have to go out of your way. The whole design is you're already going to the grocery store to buy your groceries anyway. Why not make $6 for a couple of minutes work while you're there?
What kind of person responds to these requests? Is it the same type of person who would play Pokemon Go? Because it kind of seems like a game, like going out and I'll do that. Sure.
Yeah. When Pokemon Go came out, we were kind of like, oh, that's a perfect way of putting it, and all these people were running around, for no monetary reward. We felt a lot of spirit around Pokemon Go, but really it's a wide range. We have people from all walks of life. The cell phone or smartphone penetration in Canada is really high, so we have a lot of the population that already has a smartphone. And so all they have to do is download the app. The app is free. They answer a few questions, and they can see the jobs near them. And then they can pick and choose which ones they want to do, and there's no pressure. And so, our model really works by having lots of people out there with this app, and when the jobs come up, people grab them. you know, our client gets the data really quickly, and the people who grab the jobs get paid for that work.
How do the restaurant ones work? If you ask me to go into a restaurant and order a particular thing, are you paying for that pasta salad that I now have to eat?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. You know, some tasks, potentially not. You know, if it's a coffee from a, you know, something that people buy a lot of anyway, we'll just say, hey, the next time you're buying a coffee, complete the survey. But yeah, if we're asking you to go in and order a specific pasta salad that you've never tried before, you know, we're going to front you the $7 or $8 to try it, and then we'll pay you an additional amount to complete the survey on top of that. So, you know, we try and take as much of the risk out of this for the, you know, who we call the field agents who have downloaded our app to their Apple or Android phones. And it just allows them to go out with confidence, try the salad, give us their honest feedback. And, you know, that's what our clients want as well. They don't want a professional opinion. They want the opinion of a real consumer who would walk into their restaurant and be ordering something from the lunch menu and to get that feedback.
How did the company get started? Where did it come from?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Field Agent's been around since April of 2010. The U.S. was the first country to launch.
I think I still had a flip phone in April 2010.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have been very helpful to you.
Yeah, I think I did too. And, you know, basically it was three guys. They were consumer packaged goods people as well in their past. And they're based in Northwest Arkansas, where, you know, in the land of Walmart today. And they were sitting around saying, wouldn't it be great if we had all these people and they could send us information through these smartphones? And, you know, it was a simple idea over a beer one night. And, you know, a couple of months later, there was a prototype and it was real, and they were talking to clients, and, you know, it just took off. And so, you know, in the U.S. now, you know, they have a lot of agents. It's a big, big number. It moves all the time, but it's more than 500,000 agents.
Wow.
In the U.S. You know, here in Canada, we've had 75,000 downloads since we launched in 2011. And like I'd mentioned earlier, we're in the UK and Australia and South Africa and Mexico and Romania. And so we have an international presence as well, which our clients like, because we can do a North American survey of, you know, any fast food restaurants or retail chains that might be a client.
What's the technology required to interpret the data? Because I imagine you take the photo of the cookies and you don't want someone in Arkansas flipping through those photos and checking to see if all the cookies are there. There must be some way of automating that portion.
Yeah, it's sort of hit or miss, to be honest. Automation only goes so far at the end of the day. You know, with our process in particular, every response that comes back from a field agent in a store responding to data is quality control checked by a team locally in Canada. So we're double checking that data as it comes in to make sure it's accurate. And then that data is posted to our live dashboard on the internet for our clients, so they can access the data live. And, you know, that's a big revolution in and of itself, because in the past, when you used to do this type of work, it would take a long time. There would be a report generated, and you would get it, and it would be 6 or 8 weeks old.
Right, and there'd be a meeting to present the report, too. You got to make sure there was a meeting to present the report.
Yeah, meetings. We don't, you know, we have a lot of clients we've never met face-to-face, because in this age of technology, they come to us with questions. We send them the answers back through the dashboard, and they're happy, and that's all we need. You know, it's sort of the salesman 101, you know, is when the customer stops talking, you stop talking too, you know, and that's the way to, you know, just continue the relationship, give them what they want.
I never learned that, by the way. That must have been pretty limiting for me. How do you get around cheaters or people who accidentally just do it wrong? They photograph the chocolate chip cookies instead of the Oreo cookies.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, we have a lot of built-in processes, because that was the first thing I thought, too. You know, you look at it a bit from a skeptical eye. And, you know, our quality control process is really rigorous. An agent doesn't get paid until we confirm that the job has been done at the right place and it's been done correctly. So, again, there's a human quality control team that's reviewing every submission. And they're looking at a bunch of different factors. You know, they'll look at the pictures, make sure that they took the picture of the right brand and that they were in the right store, because we have GPS readings on all of the data points that come in, so we know exactly where the person is when they're responding to the task. And then, if all those things line up, the data gets passed along to the client. If there's a mistake that's been made, we don't accept that task and we put it back up on the board to be redone by another agent. So it's really in the agent's best interest to do the work correctly the first time so that they get paid for that time.
Interesting. Interesting model. Jeff, thanks for taking the time to explain it to us.
Appreciate it. No, anytime.
Jeff Doucette is the general manager of Field Agent Canada.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are two main ways to take advantage of government policies to save for retirement. The Registered Retirement Savings Plan, the established player that's been around for 50 years, and the tax-free savings account, the relative newcomer. Today, we're going to make the case for the TFSA, potentially the better choice for at least two segments of the population, those with a low income and those with a defined benefit pension plan. Matt Ardrey is a VP and wealth advisor with Tri-Delta Financial, and he joins us now. Hello, Matt.
Good afternoon, Bruce.
Hello there. So in two sentences, maybe you could take three, identify the key differences between RRSPs and TFSAs just to set the groundwork for us.
Sure. So one of the key differences is an RRSP gives you a deduction going in and is taxable when it comes out. A TFSA does not give you a deduction when it goes in, and it's not taxable when it comes out. TFSA is completely tax-free in terms of its growth, because obviously the withdrawals have no tax implications, where the RRSP I would consider more to be tax-deferred, because you will still pay tax on that growth at one point when you do the withdrawal.
The two groups we're going to focus on where the TFSA makes particular sense is low income and DB pensions. Let's start with lower income. Why does the TFSA often make more sense for this group than the RRSP?
Sure. So the first thing is you're not – they don't often need the same sort of tax deductions on the way in. So if they're lower income in the first place, their tax brackets are marginal tax brackets are lower, thus that the RRSP deduction has less value for them than someone who's in a higher tax bracket. Conversely, when they're withdrawing it out, the RRSP becomes taxable income in retirement. And depending on how low their income is, it could affect OAS clawback, though that number is much, much higher than what we would probably typically consider someone low income. But really where it does impact is on the GIS, which is that guaranteed income supplement.
When we talk about low income in this context, what is the sort of threshold that, you know, some people who live in downtown Toronto may be making great money compared to a rural community, you know, in another province, but not be low income in this context? What's the threshold?
Sure. So the I'll give you the GIS threshold. So the GIS threshold considers your net income, which is line 236 on your tax return, if you're ever so inclined to look it up. And then what you do is you subtract what you're paid in GIS, what you receive in OAS, and you get up to about $3,500 of employment income that you can subtract from that number as well. If you're a single person and your numbers, all those numbers add up to about less than $17,500, then you're eligible to receive GIS. As a couple, about $23,000. So it is definitely on the lower end.
And that's what's going on with you in retirement. But as a working person, say you're 40 years old, say you're the sole income earner in a family, what would be the framework that you would say, TFSA probably makes more sense than an RRSP? Is it 40 grand? Is it 50 grand? What would be the number there, just as a broad rule of thumb?
Sure. So when we're looking at, and I'll use Ontario because that's where I'm living right now. So the first tax bracket takes you all the way up to $42,200. So that's taxing your income at just a little over 20%. And even going up to $45,000, $46,000, it's only at 24%. So really, you really need to start pushing that up to at least get, 30 cents back on the dollar for your RRSP deduction. And then the question is when you hit retirement, what is your income situation going to look like then? Is this RSP going to push you over the edge in terms of what you're receiving, maybe with CPP, OAS, any other sources of income? Is it going to cause that GIS or something else to be clawed back for you? Or will you even be in a higher tax bracket than you are today?
The TFSA comes in two forms. It can be a simple savings account where really it's just money, like a regular savings account. And it also could be an investing account. Would you suggest that the latter, the investing account, be a better choice?
It is if you're using it for retirement. So the way I look at it is the same way I would look at any sort of savings. If you're going to want to save for your vacation next year and you're just putting money away for a very short-term goal, then having a traditional savings account makes sense. And if you have nothing else in terms of you have a maximum amount of TFSA room, as I'm trying to say here, putting that money in there because you're going to get taxed on the interest income anyways makes sense. If you're looking at it, though, long-term, definitely having an investment account with, a strategy in place to, sort of grow your money makes a lot more sense than earning, the paltry interest rates that exist today.
One of the big disadvantages for the TFSA, in my view, is that it's quite easy to take the money out. With an RSP, there's withholding, there's all sorts of negatives to taking the money out that can act as a disincentive that don't exist for the TFSA. How do you reduce the risk that the money is going to be pulled out prematurely if indeed it is intended for retirement? It's a temptation for anyone, but for a lower income person, it could be a real need, and that would be very difficult to not take the money out early.
Absolutely. And you know what the thing is that the answer is there is nothing to stop them. There is nothing that will turn around and say, oh, you can't do that. Because if a crisis comes up, it doesn't matter if you're low income or high income and you need to access the money that, you were hoping to save for the future, but you need to access it now because of medical emergency or whatever other crisis you're dealing with. That's what you're going to go after. And there's times that people even access the money out of an RRSP and, have to have additional penalties and taxes. The only good thing about the TFSA is that whatever you take out, the next year you can start contributing back to it as the room, comes back.
If this money really is for retirement, which is the context for our conversation, how would a low-income person build the best portfolio for them? Say they're 40, they got 25 years till they're going to be accessing that money. What are the building blocks to that portfolio?
Really, I would try to be looking at, just sort of low-cost investments, design an asset mix that they're comfortable with. If it's 25 years, you might want to do a 25% equity, 25% fixed income asset mix, and then review it every year and just sort of rebalance back to those targets. One of the other ways that really works great is if they can do some sort of pre-authorized automatic contribution, so where it's comes out of your bank account and into your TFSA savings before you even get a chance to touch it. The whole sort of pay yourself first.
Now, the second group that I highlighted is people with a defined benefit pension plan. Why does a TFSA often make more sense for them than an RRSP?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Number one is they don't often have a lot of RRSP room. The pension adjustment, by virtue of them having a DB pension plan, takes away a lot of their RRSP room. Second, the pension is already coming out as taxable income, so they already have a large source, potentially, of taxable income being received in retirement, and if you add RSP income on top of that, it's going to be taxed at an even potentially higher marginal rate. Versus the TFSA, the money comes out, no taxes payable.
One last question. Some people do have the resources to have both an RRSP and a TFSA. For people in that circumstance, what type of assets should go in each? Because their treatment tax-wise is different.
Well, if you just have the RRSP and the TFSA, that's one thought. If you also have a non-registered investment account, then we're starting to look at some other things in terms of tax efficiency.
Yeah.
With RRSPs, it's often good to, you can tax shelter fixed income investments, which generate interest income. TFSA, I really try to put as much equities in as possible. Simple reason is I want that account to be as big as possible by the time it hits retirement, because all the money comes out tax-free. The one caveat that I do tell clients is if you have withholding tax on a dividend, let's say you own shares of, I don't know, Microsoft or something, and they withhold the 15% tax, there's no way to recover that. So if you have it in a non-registered investment, you'll get the foreign tax credit, which you can use against your Canadian taxes. If it's in an RSP, that's recognized by the states and they don't withhold. But in a TFSA, there's no mechanism for that. That being said, you still have all the growth that offsets it, and foreign dividends typically aren't as high as Canadian dividends.
Right. Matt, thanks for your perspective on this.
You're welcome.
Matt Ardrey is VP and Wealth Advisor with TriDelta Financial. Coming up later on Moolala, feast or famine, why income volatility is becoming a big issue for Canadians. But next, the collection agencies have you in their sights and are calling nonstop. What can you do about it? Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You think telemarketing calls are bad? Try being on the receiving end of calls from collection agencies. This is the reality for tens of thousands of Canadians. How should you handle these conversations, and what are your rights? Lori Campbell is the president of Credit Canada. She joins us now. Hello, Lori.
Hello, Bruce.
Who is calling and what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, you know, collection agencies are generally calling because the debt has been sent to a collection agency. It might have been an original creditor, such as a credit card or line of credit or whatever the case may be. The collection agency calling, asking for the debt to be repaid, and sometimes asking rather forcefully for the debt to be repaid.
Who owns these collection agencies? Are they for-profit companies?
Oh, absolutely for-profit, individual standalone companies that have been around for many years. I mean, you know, decades for that matter in some cases, well-heeled in the business of collections and have their script down pat, knowing what to do to make people to pay up.
And what are some of the things that they would say? I mean, there's the warm, friendly, hey, could you pay? And then there's the very terse, stern and almost threatening kind of comments that could come out of their mouths.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Luckily, in all the provinces in Canada, the rules have been tightened up enough so that there's less threatening activity. Bruce, I remember when I first started in my industry back, you know, over 20 years ago, the stories we'd hear about how collection agencies were trying to collect from individuals was beyond shocking. Today, you know, people still feel very intimidated by collection agencies and collectors because they say things like, you know, I'm going to sue you. This debt has to be paid immediately. How could you not pay this? How come you're ignoring me? Making people feel rather bad. But they are not allowed to use any threatening or profane or intimidating language in their collection activities and practices.
They cannot break my thumbs or even threaten to break my thumbs. That's good. So you pick up the phone. You're on the receiving end of this call. What should you say?
Well, there's a couple of things you should ask. For example, to make sure they're a legitimate collection agency, you could ask for their registration number. If they are a legitimate collection agency, no matter what province they are calling from, they're registered in that province, and you can ask for their registration number to make sure they're legit. The other thing you can ask for is something in writing from them before you even have a conversation. I mean, Joe Blow calls you up and says, hey, you owe me $10,000 for XYZ. And you're like, well, what debt? What are you talking about? I don't know about this debt. Mm. Or you might be sketchy. You might have a few things in collection. And you're not sure what debt they're referring to. Ask for something in writing. You have the right to have that.
They don't provide resources, do they? When they call you, they're really trying to get paid, but they're not providing you with a pathway to payment.
Well, they want to get paid as quickly as possible, and sometimes they get overzealous in the way that they try to collect to make you pay. And sometimes it really just turns people off. Well, if you're not going to give me the information I need to satisfy myself and knowing that you are who you say you are and this debt is what you're saying you're collecting on, chances are people won't pay. Mm. But there is that element of fear. A lot of people may not know their rights with a collection agency, and they may pay without understanding those rights.
Who enforces those rights? So consumers have rights. There's some nuance depending on the region of the country that you live in. But what are some of the rights and who enforces those rights for consumers?
Okay. So there are certain things that the collection, and I'll tell you who enforces them. There are certain things that a collection agency cannot do. So they can't contact you on a Sunday except between 1 and 5 p.m. And in some provinces, they can't contact you on a Sunday at all. So take a look at your province and what the rules are. They can't contact you between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. So they can't contact you anytime after 9 o'clock at night or anytime before 7 or in some province 8 a.m. in the morning. So if they're contacting you at odd hours that seem very strange, that's a big red flag. They should not be contacting you on a holiday. They cannot use any kind of, as I say, threatening or profane language. They can't use any undue or excessive, you know, pressure to harass you. You know, you better pay. You know, do you realize what kind of situation you're putting your family in? You know, those types of things that make you feel very uncomfortable. And they can't charge you any fees outside of what you owe. Mm. So those are things that you need to be aware of. Now, who, as I say, that each collection agency is registered in the province that they work in. So they are, I guess, responsible or they answer to that province. And the province can actually levy fines against collection agencies that do not follow the rules or even revoke their status. So if you have a complaint, you can complain to the ministry in charge of that collection agency. In Ontario, for example, it's the Ministry of Consumer Services. And one of the biggest complaints they get every year is about collection agencies.
Are you obligated to answer their call? And if you do answer it, are you obligated to talk to them?
Well, you know, here's the thing. You can run away as much as you want, right?
You can run, but you can't hide.
You can run, but you can't hide. So you're not obligated to pick up any phone call. Let's face it, they can only phone you 3 times a week. But that's if they get your voicemail, they speak to you in person, or they contact you through email. If you phone and it doesn't go to voicemail, just keeps ringing and ringing, they can call you all week doing that. And at some point, you may want to pick up the phone and acknowledge what's going on. Having said that, there is, you know, there are some strange rules around a period of time that could go by where the debt is ungarnishable. And that's usually 2 years without any contact. So, you know, if they don't get you and nobody has contacted you within 2 years, chances are a creditor going to sue you cannot actually sue you because that time period has elapsed.
Who else can these collection agencies call? Can they call your boss? Can they call your mom? Can they call other people in your life?
Well, in some provinces, they can actually call your employer just to find out if you're actually employed there. That's it. But they cannot call your employer, other than that, they can't call your employer. Unless your employer has guaranteed the debt, and then actually your employer actually owes the money as well. Or if there's a court order for garnishment, and they need to be able to execute on that garnishment.
Well, so tell me about how that goes. Garnishing of wages and also repossession. I mean, is that happens on TV a lot, where they come and take your couch. Does that happen in the real world?
They generally know. No, they're not going to take your couch away in the real world, but they could, you know, they could repossess your car.
And what circumstances would garnishing happen?
Garnishing would happen if they tried to contact you, they've tried to get you to satisfy the debt, they know that you're working and you're avoiding them, they may take you to court where they have to get a judgment to execute a garnishment. Now, keeping in mind also, Bruce, that garnishment's good for 20 years. So if you're not working, a couple years down the road you are, they can execute on that garnishment, which is 20% of your wage.
As I mentioned, when they call you, they're trying to get their debt back, but they're not saying, here, can I help you with a budget, or here, can I provide you with some resources? That role falls to people like you at Credit Canada and other nonprofit credit counseling organizations across this country. If someone receives the call and realizes they need help, please insert your basic message here of how your organization can help them.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's the thing. People are so afraid, and I totally understand. I mean, collection agencies can be very intimidating. So if you're getting calls like this, you don't know what to do. We're a not-for-profit charitable organization that's actually served the community, if you can believe, for 50 years now. And the main goal of the organization at Credit Canada is to help people who are experiencing financial difficulty look at resolution to get over that hump. Talk to your creditors so you don't have to, and that means the collection agencies, and often we won't even deal with the collection agencies. We'll go right back to the original creditor that you owe and negotiate with them to get the collection agency right out of the picture if we can, so that you can actually have some peace of mind, look at a repayment structure that works for you, or look at options that are best for you to resolve your financial situation. So I highly recommend it, especially for those individuals that just don't know where to turn.
Yeah.
They feel that, you know, they feel that no matter where they go, the situation is following them around. They might even think that they, you know, these collection agencies are going to call their friends and their family. Now, they're not supposed to, but, you know, we've heard these things do happen still.
Right. Lori, thank you very much for your insight. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Bruce.
Lori Campbell is the president of Credit Canada. Well, stay with us. Coming up, Ask Anything, what to do with retirement savings when you live in a different country. But first, the flexible workforce has some pros, but it also has some cons. We'll look at the cash flow crisis next. Stay with us.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
It's one thing to live within your means when you know what your income is going to be, but how do you budget when you can't predict it? Income volatility is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and there are calls for government to do something about it. Liz Mulholland is the CEO of Prosper Canada, a national charity focused on financial empowerment for Canadians living in poverty. Hello there.
Good morning, Bruce.
The data is pretty shocking. 40% of Canadians experienced high levels of income volatility in the last year. This is from a TD study. What does this actually mean?
What it actually means is that month to month, people have incomes that fluctuate so much that it actually becomes very challenging for them to plan financially, to save money, and in some cases, because it's creating a big gap between their monthly income and their monthly expenses, and they don't have that much flexibility on their expenses. We all have mortgages or rent and car payments, et cetera, that they actually have to borrow money to make ends meet that month. And so one of the things that we're speculating is that it may be one of the causes of rising household debt in Canada, although we don't know yet. We really have to do more research.
For a third of those people, the fluctuation was 25%, which for those people who have jobs, they get the same amount of money every 2 weeks. It comes into their bank account. That's a shocking number. And I can't even imagine how one would begin to plan with that much variability.
Yeah, and I'm not sure anybody knows how to teach them how to plan for that kind of variability. You know, you can say, well, plan, assume the lowest possible amount and budget around that, but that's not realistic for many people. So I think we're struggling, if we're in the business of financial education or supporting people, with how do you actually equip somebody to cope in that situation? And we know that it's a growing problem for many people, not just people with low income, but right up the income ladder. So,
what are some of the broad things happening in the job market that are driving this volatility?
I think what we've seen over the past 30 years is a rise in what the experts like to call precarious work, but it really means moving from having lots of jobs that are secure, steady, and come with lots of great benefits, to now moving into more people being not in a permanent job, but working contract jobs, moving from gig to gig, so to speak, or working in hourly wage jobs where their shifts or the number of hours they work may fluctuate week to week, and they can't really tell ahead of time how many hours they're going to work. More people cobbling together income from multiple contracts or part-time jobs. Again, some of them may be shift work or hourly, and they may not know how much income from any one of those they're going to have in any given month. And then more people who are self-employed, which again can come with large fluctuations in income.
It's not hard to wrap your mind around the implications of this volatility, including, as you say, the need for debt, and in particular, the risk that they might go to payday loans and be paying egregious amounts of interest just to get by each month. what seems to be more difficult are brainstorming some solutions. What are ways that governments, employers, financial institutions can mitigate this issue?
Well, we've been looking at the United States, where they're a couple of years ahead of us on the curve, and they've started pulling together the different players from across the board to look at what solutions might look like. And I think they've arrived on a few things. One is for governments to look at employment standards and say, we know that we want flexibility for businesses to operate, but have we struck the right balance? Should we be asking employers to give their employees more notice around their shifts so that they can plan around that? Should we be making it easier or requiring employers to offer more employees the option to have some benefits? On the other side of the equation, I think they're looking at what can banks and financial institutions do. So are there ways to look at our products and services so they can better support people who have volatile incomes? I think what they call fintech, the rise of technology solutions to help people manage their money. There's some interesting new applications being developed that will help people manage their savings through micro savings to help them build up emergency accounts to help smooth those income expense gaps. So there's a lot of work going on in a whole variety of places. And then even some solutions that are much bigger that involve things like moving towards a basic income where everybody would get a certain basic income amount from the government every year, every month, and that then they can supplement that by working in the labor market. But at the very least, nobody would find themselves unable to pay a basic rent or put food on their table if their income was wildly fluctuating.
Micro savings, is this the idea where you round up on each transaction and then the bank sets that incremental amount aside for you? Is that what that means?
That's one application of it. I think there are others that there are applications that look at what your fixed expenses are every month. And then as the month goes on, they look at how much surplus you have, and they kind of take little opportunities to sock away $5 there, $10 there, but careful not to drop you below the line that you need to meet your fixed expenses. But when you get to the end of the month, you find your app has squirreled away $40 for you that you didn't even feel, but you're still able to pay your rent and pay your utility bill, et cetera, and your car payment.
One of the things you wrote about is financial institutions and how they could develop customer financial health metrics, which I love. I love the idea. It sounds a little bit like rainbows and unicorns to me, given that we live in a culture where our for-profit banks have quarterly earnings pressures. And if it was really important to them to have their customer be healthy financially, they'd start by just weeding them off debt. It would be the first thing they would do. It wouldn't be so hard. So is this a serious suggestion? I don't mean to mock it. I'm just being playful. But tell me more about it and how it might work.
Yeah, this idea came out of, the United States, the Center for Financial Services Innovation, which is a very serious organization that works to build consumer financial health, but works in partnership with financial institutions and financial technology companies, as well as governments. And they've actually been working with a number of financial institutions, and I think the credit unions kind of went there first, but they do have a few banks that have instituted kind of customer financial health metrics that they're applying. Very few of them are applying them across the board, but they're starting to dip their toe in the water. And they're using these to actually, one, help consumers understand their own financial health and where they might look to improve, but also helping the bank itself to better understand the needs and the financial situation of their consumers so that they can work with them to give them products and services that will actually help them move those metrics. It is interesting, and I have to say CFSI has had calls and inquiries from Canadian banks, so we know that they are actually looking at it. I don't think it's a slam dunk to move there overnight. It's a big shift for a bank to build a double bottom line around moving consumer financial health and its business bottom line, but I think more and more financial institutions are kind of coming to the conclusion that Henry Ford did, If people can't afford to buy my car, then there's no point in me making them.
Right.
And banks are realizing that if people are in such dire financial straits that they're going down a financial rabbit hole, then banks aren't going to thrive in the long term either.
Right.
So I think everybody has an interest in lifting everybody up, and banks are starting to realize that it also can be an important competitive differentiator if their customers find that their bank is doing more to help them build their financial health, to track their financial health, and support them to achieve their financial goals. That can build a much stronger customer-bank relationship.
The virtuous circle. Liz, thank you very much. We'll focus on that. Liz Mulholland is the CEO of Prosper Canada.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Coming up next, stranded savings. What to do when you don't live in the same country as your retirement nest egg. And Liz Mulholland of Prosper Canada answers the Moolala questionnaire. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show on iTunes or go to moolala.ca and download specific segments. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. It's time now for Ask Anything, your questions answered by one of our experts. Today, Matt Ardrey is here. He's VP and Wealth Advisor with TriDelta Financial. Hello there, Matt.
Hi, Bruce.
The first question, and I'm going to read it out. It's, I contribute to RSPs through my work in Canada where I am a citizen but not a resident. I live in the U.S. Most of my work is in the U.S. and I pay tax there on all my world income. My question is it just better to leave those RSPs until I'm able to withdraw from them? Will I have problems doing so since I'm not a resident of the country? I know I'll have to pay taxes on those RSPs when I withdraw from them, but is that all that's required as a non-resident? What do you think?
Well, first and foremost, obviously, if the person's living in the United States, they would be paying tax on the worldwide income. So if they took money out of the RSP, that's Canada's income, so they pay tax there. Canada typically charges a 25% withholding tax on any lump sum withdrawals. Much less than what a lot of people would be paying if they were just taking it out as a Canadian resident. But what if the person can wait until it's a RIF, their payments could be considered periodic pension payments. And under the U.S.-Canada tax treaty, the withholding tax drops from 25 down to 15%. So again, you know, that's some way they could, you know, if they are willing to wait, they can definitely, you know, hold off and save some tax that way. If they're not filing in Canada and contributing to an RSP, the one thing they're really missing out on is the tax deduction. So if you're filing no income taxes to Canada, the U.S. is not giving you an RSP deduction. So really the way I'm sort of thinking of it is you're putting money in, not getting a deduction. It grows tax deferred, yes. But when you pull it out, you pay tax. So how beneficial really is that?
So you'd say, can you avoid those contributions and take that money home? Don't worry about the deferral because it's not being helpful to you, and invest it maybe in some sort of a 401k or something like that in the U.S.?
That's right.
Interesting. Well, a part two of this is the flip side for someone. Now, I was someone who used to live in the U.S. What happens if you have retirement savings there in a 401k or an IRA? They have their own alphabet soup of acronyms down there, too. How do you think about that?
Well, it's, you know, one thing you can do with a with an IRA is you can repatriate it to Canada. You can repatriate it to Canada and actually put it into your RRSP. It's a little bit of a complicated process, and I wouldn't advise anyone just to sort of try to take a stab at it on their own. Essentially, the first thing you have to find out from your administrator is, do they consider your withdrawal sort of a periodic payment or not? Some of them will withhold 15%, some of them will withhold 30% tax. So that can make a really big difference. If you are willing to roll it into an RSP, really what's going to happen is even if they withhold the 15% tax, so let's say someone had a $100,000 in their IRA, they would have a $100,000 income inclusion in Canada. It generates one year, one time RSP room of $100,000. But since you had 15% withholding, you have $85,000 to put in. So right now you have a $15,000 income inclusion in Canada. If you have the extra money, you can put the extra $15,000 in the RSP, then your income inclusion's sort of at zero. The one thing that does come out of it, though, is this $15,000 of withholding tax. Again, that's a one-year foreign tax credit. So if you don't have another $15,000 or so of taxes payable in Canada against which you can use that, that money is going to be lost. So you really have to consider your specific tax situation before you just go ahead and say, yeah, I just want to move it back to Canada.
And is there a connection to the amount of RRSP room you have here, or does this operate in a different universe? Is it sort of considered almost like a U.S. RRSP, so you don't have to worry about the room?
That's right. You don't have to worry about the room. So the amount you're transferring in a corresponding amount of room sort of appears for 1 year on your tax return. You've got this 1 year of one-time shot of room, and that's it. It only exists for the year that you make the rollover. It does not carry forward like regular RRSP room, so you can almost consider it a special RRSP contribution room.
People live and work all over the world these days. What are the kinds of characteristics that you'd recommend people look for when they're looking for help in navigating these issues, be they tax or investing? How do you find the right person for the job?
Well, it comes down to lots of times to experience, experience in education. There's definitely, if you're looking at the United States, there's more and more cross-border firms and more cross-border experts cropping up that can definitely help you with the tax situation. The investment situation can be a little trickier. There's a lot of times that firms can't deal with non-residents, especially in the U.S., you know, they get tied up in SEC regulations and whatnot. There's only a certain amount of U.S. Residents they can have on their books, so on and so forth. So you do get people. I was actually talking to someone today, who was dealing with a major bank, and they can't really deal in terms of getting any of their investments changed or anything along those lines, just quite simply because of regulations and dealing with non-residents.
How connected is the IRS to the CRA? Really, what I want to know is, if you do something, is the tax body on the other side of the border going to know about it?
Like a lot of things that come in, you know, the personal finance world, the answer is, it depends.
Right.
They do talk to each other to a certain extent, but it depends on, how major it is, how much it affects it. Lots of times, especially when you look at the CRA, it's sort of a self-reporting system. So there's lots of people out there who do things that are not exactly, in the black or white. They're sort of in this gray area, and CRA doesn't come to audit them. Well, it's never decided whether they're black or white. So again, this sort of same sort of thing can happen. But the thing is you've got to really quantify your risk. Do you really want to be taking that sort of tax risk on?
Yeah. Matt, thanks very much for your insight.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Appreciate it. Matt Ardrey is VP and Wealth Advisor with TriDelta Financial. Time now for the Moolah La Questionnaire. It is a series of questions about money and a little bit about life. Liz Mulholland is the CEO of Prosper Canada, a national charity focused on financial empowerment for Canadians living in poverty. You ready, Liz?
I am.
Just the first thing that comes to your mind, I might ask a supplementary question or two, but the first question is this. How would you describe your money personality? That was a big sigh. Wow. That was a very big sigh. Is it because your personality is inconsistent with the values of Prosper Canada? Are you secretly like a super huge spender?
No, I'm not a super huge spender, but I would have to say that money does not loom large in what I personally, like my personal goals. I think social impact does, and money is just a means to the end. So I'm very interested in money and helping people with their money to achieve social goals. I really don't like spending any time working on my own money situation.
Yeah. I feel the same way, by the way, and I focus on financial literacy for a living, and I would rather, I don't know, pull out my own teeth with a crowbar than file my taxes. So, you know, you're in good company.
I don't mind filing my taxes, but I would say what I like to do is set a few ground rules that will keep me on track and then just stick to those.
Yeah.
And not spend a lot of time on the fine-tuned stuff.
Yeah, yeah. What
so
is
high efficiency.
High efficiency. Your money personality is high efficiency. I love it. What is one money topic you could talk about every single day? Your passion for it is so true and so deep, you could talk about it every single day.
The importance of tax filing.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I would be, you know what? Tell me why. I have a hypothesis as to why. Tell me why that's so important.
One, I think it's important for everybody to do it because then we have a healthier society.
Yeah.
For the people that we work with who are low or modest income, tax filing is the pipeline through which many of our social benefits flow. And many people who are struggling to make ends meet could increase their income if they did tax file.
Yes, and they might not know that.
They might not know that, or they may have difficulty tax filing on their own, or there may be complexities to their tax picture that they need help with, but they may not know where to go to get that help.
What is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever, ever had to talk about again? For me, it's taxes. For you, it's not going to be taxes. What's it going to be for you?
What is it? Oh, you know what I can't figure out is cell phones and pricing and all that.
Cell phone plans, all that. Yes.
I become a temporary expert. I can't cope.
Yeah. I become a temporary expert and then endeavor not to do anything about it for the next year.
Well, I'll call you next.
You call me. I'll tell you. As long as I'm in a period of temporary expertise. When do you plan to retire and what will you do?
I have no clear sense of when I'll retire, but I'm not a planner. I plan very little of my life. I just let it unfold. But I will probably do volunteer work with children. I will garden. I will spend part of the year in Europe and part of it in beautiful Canada, exploring it even more and just hang out. But it'll probably be, I'll be well into my 70s before I really retire, I think.
Right. Right. Well, I hope your knees will be still well so you can bend down and weed that garden in your 70s.
But I won't be working at the level I work now.
Right. That's for sure. Okay.
It'll be a gradual decline.
One last question. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, just snapping your fingers, what would it be?
Saving patterns. Yeah, people would save a little bit all the time.
Liz, thank you very much for that.
That's great. Thank
I appreciate
you very
it.
Much
Liz Mulholland is the CEO of Prosper Canada. Have a great day. Well, that is our program for today. Thank you for joining us. To listen to past episodes, you can head on over to iTunes. You can subscribe. The episode will just arrive on your iPad. You can send us questions here to ask@moolala.ca or on Twitter @Bruce Selry, on Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Thanks again for listening. Have a great day.